Hello and welcome to the Anne and Phelan Scoop.
My name is Anne McElhenney.
And I'm Phelan McElhenney. And where are we, Anne?
We're at home with Mr. Top Cat.
Oh, there he is.
And Security Cat, by the way, is out and about in the neighbourhood.
Yes.
There's a verb for that, which we're not going to use today because we're being polite on the show.
It's a doing word.
It's a doing word, yeah. Yes. It's week 88 and that's 1 year and 9 months since the 2 weeks to flatten the curve lockdown. And we are home from the shoot of My Son Hunter.
Yes,
we are back from Serbia.
Where was the hunt?
Where was the shoot? Was in Serbia, in Belgrade. I know we had a lot of people complaining about my inability to say Belgrade and I'll constantly say Bulgaria. So we were in Belgrade.
Belgradia.
We were in Belgrade and we got back yesterday, literally just yesterday. We flew from Belgrade to Istanbul, Istanbul direct to Los Angeles. 14 hours.
In total.
13 hours and 55 minutes.
And you had a wonderful flight home, didn't you?
I had a terrible flight home because basically a guy, Phelan and I, by the way, and this is an unusual thing. A lot of people find this very unusual.
Yes.
Phelan and I never sit together on planes. Never. There you go. We just don't sit together on planes. And it's not anything like the royal family. It's not like we could travel on two different planes in case the plane goes down. No, no, it's actually worse than that. We don't sit together on planes because we spend a lot of time together. We're actually the opposite of most people. I thought about that yesterday. I remember having a friend years ago and I remember her saying that she needed to go on holidays with her husband because that's the only time she got to talk to him because they were so busy in their lives.
Yes.
And so we're the very opposite of that. Yes. We talk to each other all the time. So when we get on the plane, it's like, you know what? It'd be nice to just be on my own now.
That's right.
And also the priority would be to get the good seat. So I got a really good seat, Phelan. Got a really good seat. And then I'm like, and I was great. And we did
and you,
fly.
And you, and you fell asleep?
I fell asleep and we were like, I was all relaxed. Very
and the great
happy.
Thing about these long flights is you can actually get a good 8 hours sleep on them, right? As opposed to like if you're going from Ireland, let's say, to Washington. It's a 5 hour flight. By the time you get some food and all, you get a couple of hours. But anyway, so you were all set for your 8 hour sleep.
I was delighted with myself.
And you were asleep,
dinner.
In fact.
I had my dinner. I read a few things. I'd done a few things. I'd sent a few messages. And then I thought, lovely, yum, yum, yum. I'm going to have a really nice sleep.
Food was
now.
Very good on Turkish Airlines.
Food was very nice on Turkish Airlines. So I lay down, all delighted myself. Sleep, really nice sleep. The next thing I could hear this noise, like really loud noise.
And it woke you out of your
and
sleep.
And basically woke me out of my sleep. And it was somebody listening to videos on their phone without a headphone set. And by the way, the sound out of a phone on top of everything else is that really awful sort of staticky sound. So basically there was a man watching his videos. So it took me a while to realise. I woke up. It took me a while to realise what was happening. And then I get up and our friend, one of the other producers, has already gone over to speak to the guy. So I was already standing at that stage and I said, stop, whatever. But I was totally awake at that stage. Mm. And by the way, the same guy did it twice. And when I went and approached him the second time, he was really aggressive towards me and said, go back to your seat. Go back and sit down. So then I went to the air hostess, air steward, whatever you're meant to say nowadays.
It's Turkish, probably.
Air hostess. Exactly. The air hostess and said, you know, this guy... And they took care of him.
They took care of him.
They took care of him. But so, yeah, so anyway. So
enough of our...
I had very little sleep.
Very little sleep, but good night's sleep. So anyway, that's a very long intro to our podcast today. What's on the podcast today?
Well, we have very, very big news from the set of My Son Hunter that we will tell you in a moment.
Yeah, well, lots of news, actually. Lots of news. Some of you might know, some of you might
not. And what else have we got for
you? And the New York Times has a scoop about Hunter Biden. Wow. That actually isn't a scoop, but it was reported by a conservative media outlet before the election. But then the media had decided then to suppress negative news about the Biden family corruption. So we're going to bring you the full details of the scoop that wasn't.
And we have a story from Wisconsin, the Wisconsin massacre, the horrible story that happened in the last few days.
And it's basically the responsibility caused by Soros-backed progressive policies, and we'll tell you why.
And Phelan has a story from the Irish Independent that he wants to surprise me with, which I don't even know what it is.
I want to read it to you, and I want you to tell me. Anyway,
we'll come to that. And this week, by the way, of course, is Thanksgiving, and I know all of you, a lot of people are travelling over the country and travelling over the holidays, and we'll be travelling ourselves. We're going to a friend's wedding out in Palm Springs. Really excited about that. But we thought for this Thanksgiving, most Thanksgivings lately we've spent with Dennis Prager, and we've really loved that, but we just got back last night. So today what we're going to do is we're going to be joined by a very dear, dear friend of ours who is also a dear friend of yours and a great inspiration to all of us to talk about a very heartwarming story that will be just perfect for Thanksgiving.
Yes, we're
going to end today with a recipe from Serbia. We had a recipe last week for the Shopska salad, which was very like a national dish from Serbia. And this week is a really great Serbian dish that I think is actually kind of perfect in time for the holidays, in time for Christmas, and in time for Thanksgiving. A kind of, it's a thing that you could make for a big gang of people coming over to the house. So I'm really happy to share that with you later on.
So, but
big news from the set, Phelim.
Well, there's lots of big news. Actually, the biggest news of all is we have announced, and you may have seen some media coverage of it, Gina Carano, the actress and the MMA fighter, and apparently cancelled actress as well. Gina Carano, she is joining the cast of, she has joined the cast of My Son Hunter. She plays a world-weary Secret Service agent. I don't want to give too many details, but
let's just watch her now announce that herself.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Gina Carano. I'm here on the set of My Son Hunter, the story of Hunter Biden and Joe Biden. We're in Belgrade, Serbia. It's such an incredible place. And I'm working with Lawrence Fox, one of the most amazing humans ever that I've found in 2020. So I'm so excited to be here.
She's the best. Absolute best. I'm going to take my clothes off.
Lawrence Fox is somebody I found in 2020, and it's an absolute gem. I'm such a big fan of his, so to be working with him is incredible. And then Robert Davi, somebody who reached out to me after I got canceled. So he's our fearless leader, our director, somebody who I admire, and somebody who I believe is painting an incredible picture right now. And then John James is playing Joe Biden. John is just one of my favorite human beings, absolutely talented, amazing, and gentle-spirited. I just don't think it gets better than where I'm at right now. I'm so excited to be creating art, and I believe groundbreaking art. I believe what Robert Davi is doing with this film is just absolutely groundbreaking. The story, the cast, the crew, the people, this is what makes art great, and this is what we're doing. And I can't wait for you to see it.
So she's just amazing.
And you saw Lawrence Fox, they get on like a house on fire. They had a great time. We all had a great time. And it was a lot of fun. And actually, she really brought a, you know, she came into the set just as, you know, we're hitting the third week mark. People were tired. You know, we'd all told each other all our best stories all that. And we'd been working together 16 hours a day. We'd been with Robert Davi, the director, you know, for a month of pre-production, you know. So suddenly we had this beautiful person with a smile, with a kindness, with a gentleness, just coming in and making us all behave again. So making Americans behave again, I think, was Gina's motto. So it was great to have her on the set. Great, just have that, and she brought a real, I think, a creative fresh air to the set as well.
We should tell the story maybe perhaps about what happened to Gina when she came on the set, and that, you know, she had only arrived a couple of days, and one of her co-stars in her last movie was discovered dead in his sleep in Austin, Texas. Yes. And she just really loved him, and they were very close. So that was a lot for her to go through.
But she powered through.
And she was such fun.
As Robert said, you know, you got to try and bring whatever tragedy you're suffering into the role. You got to try and use it.
She had humor too. I mean, I was telling her, it's kind of a funny story, and she did enjoy this story, but I was sort of telling her that I got this crazy notion from Magda that a great way to lose weight is to do this OMAD, eat one meal a day. So I started doing that during the thing, and I did it for like a couple of weeks, and it was all going fine until basically, and I was losing weight. You even noticed that, Phelim, right?
Yes.
Look at Top Cat. So basically the next thing that happened though was I started to get these pains everywhere. So I had basically muscular pain everywhere, and I thought this has to be connected to this OMAD, right? So then I was telling Gina about it, my new best friend Gina. I was saying to Gina, look, God bless us, I'm trying this thing and maybe I'm in ketosis, I don't know, but I've got these terrible muscular pains. And she said, oh yeah, that sounds like that's what's wrong with you. And she said, you know, really what you need to do is, look, we're in a stressful situation here, we're on the set, you need to listen to your body. You know, this is my new best friend Gina Carano, who knows a lot about bodies and knows a lot about fitness and knows a lot about nutrition and all that. Yes. She said, you need to listen to your body. And I said to her, you know, that's fine there, Gina, for you, right? But what if your body is saying to you, vodka up straight and salt caramel ice cream for dinner every day? You know, that's kind of the downside of that.
Actually.
For breakfast, you know, depending on what your body, see, I would say Gina Carano's body is saying to her things like
lettuce,
raw carrots.
Yes.
Let's do carrots for a week. You know, I would imagine that. I never hear about carrots from my body. My body never talks about carrots. My body talks a lot about tequila, a lot. Talks a lot about salted caramel ice cream, a lot.
It does.
Talks about a lot of carbohydrates.
I can confirm that.
Continuously talks a lot about sourdough bread, croissants. I can tell you that I can hear from my body all the time, but I just think that the message is possibly not the message that Gina Carano was suggesting. Anyway, she's a total dote and we are so glad to have her.
And in fact, she was very useful on the set, not just as a brilliant actor.
Oh my God.
Because John James, who you may remember from as Jeff Colby from Dynasty, John James was playing Hunter.
Americans say Dynasty film.
Do they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's their problem. You know, by the way, it's also being reshot in Serbia. We'll come on to that in a moment. John James, who from the Dynasty or Dynasty?
Dynasty.
Okay, you Americans. Okay, it's Thanksgiving. I'll succumb to the American pronunciation. John James, who was in Dynasty and then Colby's, he was playing Joe Biden, President Joe Biden.
Just it's amazing.
And by the way, that was a picture I took with my iPhone. Where do you see the pictures that have been taken with beautiful cameras and beautiful lighting? So John James was going, and it's very important to say, going to a restaurant for dinner, not coming from the restaurant. So he was not inebriated in any way. He was going into the restaurant and walked into the side of a glass door and caused a serious injury on his face. And it was very funny. He came back to the hotel and there was the manager and there was Gina Carano, who has some experience.
She was with him when this happened. So Gina was with him. And it's kind of funny the way they told the story, actually. We weren't there. But Lawrence Fox was there and Gina was
playing
there.
Lawrence is playing Hunter Biden.
And Lawrence, by the way, Lawrence and John both. I love this kind of stuff, by the way. And it's so true of life. Both of those men are pathetic in the face of blood and stuff like that. So the two of them were like, you know, beside themselves. They just weren't able to know what to do with themselves. Mm-hmm. They were scared. You know, and basically, well, John leaned forward and basically, he first of all, when he touched his head or whatever, he said there was a bit of blood. Then he kind of leaned forward and suddenly there's this like pool of blood on the ground. But of course, Gina is there and she is like, she has seen this before. She's been in the ring. She was an MMA fighter. So she basically is like, oh yeah, she had a look at it and she went, maybe you're going to need one stitch. And of course, she was completely right. But she was very reassuring. And it was actually, I think having her there reassured Lawrence, reassured John James that everything was going to be fine. But they came back to the hotel and she was like the rock star. She was taking over everything. Yes. But then the hotel manager came, Nicholas.
And he wanted to do some work. But then we decided, no, he has to go to hospital. But this is Saturday evening. Now, not quite. It was about Saturday evening, about 8 or 9 o'clock. So the craziness of the ER departments all over the world. Every ER department all over the world is crazy on Saturday night. I think we got in just before the craziness. And then he got in. I'm kind of ashamed to say, I think he may have got slightly preferential treatment. But anyway, he got in pretty quickly. Wonderful. I mean, they were so professional. I mean, they were so...
I think one of the things, and you correct me if I'm wrong about this, is I think that they did the stitch without giving him any kind of pain medication. Is that correct?
I think that's right.
I think that was it. And I was like, but John was a total trooper about it. And I think he sort of almost enjoyed it. And Nicholas, who is the manager of the hotel, who is really, really spectacular and is a massive fan of John's. Like, I think we may have mentioned this before. When John was checking into the hotel, when he was arriving from the airport, Phelim and I miscalculated the time. We had planned to go to the airport to meet him. Anyway, he was suddenly coming in the transport. So we stayed, you know, at the foyer of the hotel to greet him. And suddenly we saw the manager of the hotel pacing back and forth in the lobby. Mm-hmm. And we're like, Nicholas, what's going on? He went, Jeff Colby is coming. I love Jeff Colby, you know. And so he was so nice. And John then told me afterwards, when they brought him to his room, Nicholas had all of the staff lined up in the room to sort of don their hats at John, which was really nice. But of course, John had just traveled like the rest of us, 16 hours from Nashville. And he's like really tired. And he's like having to say hello. And he's so polite and he's such a charming man. He wanted to say hello to all the staff. But he said it was really funny that Nicholas had them all lined up in the room for him.
Yeah.
But
So he got the stitch. And then the story somehow got in the Daily Mail, as you can see here. Here's a headline.
Shocker.
And the photographs I took somehow got in the Daily Mail.
That's very funny.
Anyway, we offered it to the Daily Mail and they loved the story. But then it became a major story in Serbia. And it's coupled with the fact that they're reshooting Dynasty. So they're reshooting Dynasty in Serbia, in Serbian, but using the original scripts. So every script, the original music.
And even more weird than that, one of the locations where we shot, the day before, they had shot an episode of their new dynasty in that very location. Yeah. And John's like looking at me going, this is freaky, right? Like, this was super freaky, but he was enjoying himself so much and he was so glad. Yeah. But he has done such an incredible job. I think we were even surprised at the likeness and the fact that as the days went forward, yes, he more and more and more occupied the role of Joe Biden.
He grew into the role.
I mean, and we've been looking, obviously, we were there on the set, but we were looking at footage afterwards. He walked like Joe Biden. It's absolutely extraordinary.
He really grew into the role. Let's show some of the pictures that we've released, actually, off the movie. There's Lawrence as Hunter Biden. You might, if you're easily shocked or offended, you might want to hide your eyes at the moment because we're trying to keep it fairly family friendly. But you have to show the debauchery of Hunter Biden.
Well, the thing is, I mean, I thought about this the other day because, I mean, of course, you know what we're like. I mean, we want everything to be family friendly. There's no family friendly way of telling this story. And by the way, that's something that, you know, we're going to be saying that more and more as we go forward. This is what happened. We know this is what happened because Hunter Biden wrote this himself in his own memoir. Plus, we have obviously access to the laptop, and this is what has been revealed. So, mm-hmm. you know, what are we going to do? We're not going to sugarcoat it. We are not going to change the history. We're not going to change reality like a lot of journalists do. We're going to tell the truth of what actually happened. And it is shocking, and it is R-rated. It is adult content.
This movie's only been made because you have donated to it. You have made it happen.
So, yeah, so this brings us to, like, guys, we are so grateful to everyone who has donated to make this film possible and to allow us to shoot in Serbia and to tell the truth and get this story out, which has been suppressed for far too long. So it's coming up to Thanksgiving, and we are really close right now to $2 million, which is amazing. We have a generous donor who has gotten in touch with us and who is willing to give us $50,000 when we reach $2 million. We would really ask you, particularly now that it's Thanksgiving and we're so grateful for so much in our lives, we would ask you, and I know you guys have been so generous already, please, please, please give what you can right now before Thanksgiving to allow us to get to that 2 million mark and mm-hmm. get this generous donor to give us that $50,000. That's really, really necessary to get this film made in the way that we want it made and finished in the way that we want it finished. So please do that. All you've got to do is go to mysonhunter.com. All of your contributions are tax deductible. We're a 501c3 and we cannot do this work without you. We cannot. We can't keep the lights on without you. So
it's great. I mean, and we've come back from almost 2 months now in Serbia. And, you know, there was, when you looked at that rap party we had on Saturday night, like there was probably, you know, 50, 60 people working to tell this story.
And great people, by the way. Great people. I mean, people like Robert Davi was saying, you know, that in terms of like the DP, in terms of the first AD, in terms of all the crew that we had in Serbia, really, really high quality people. And they worked, everyone was working, basically every day was a 12-hour day. Yeah. Many days went longer than that. A lot of times in the dark, a lot of times in the cold, a lot of night shoots. We finished at 3 or 4 in the morning. And you made it happen, and we're really grateful. But we're tired, but very grateful.
But we want to keep going. We want to make this film even better and make sure it can get out to as many people as possible. So please go to mysonhunter.com
and give what you can.
So talking of suppressed stories.
Well, just as well, actually, to even re-emphasize how important telling the story of the Biden family corruption is. Here's a little story of the Biden family corruption.
So the New York Times has finally discovered Biden family corruption. And
they broke this amazing story for them, right? They broke this story.
About Hunter. So the Chinese wanted to buy a cobalt mine. Cobalt is needed for batteries for electric cars. And the Democratic Republic of Congo, which probably is neither democratic nor the republic nor a republic, has almost all the world's supply of cobalt. So it was there. An American company wasn't doing much with it. The Chinese wanted to buy it to monopolize their control of cobalt. And so they decided to buy it off the American company. But they had a very strange way of buying it. They bought it through an intermediate company called Bohai Harvest Resources. And guess who owns that intermediate company? Mr. Hunter Biden. So I think it was a $1.2 billion deal that the Chinese allowed Hunter Biden to buy, and then they bought in a planned deal, they bought the cobalt mine off Hunter Biden's company. And I assume he got a large chunk of change as a result. Completely unnecessary, but very useful if you want to influence Joe Biden and get Joe Biden to work for you. So this is the New York Times, right? This is the New York Times, and they've just published this story. But the actual reality is this is not a scoop. This story was published before the election by the Washington Free Beacon. And it was exactly the same story. And in fact, in my opinion, carried some of the possible errors. Both stories had errors, or not errors, but things that I don't trust because I know a lot about mining in these parts of the world. But they were both stories. Hunter Biden profited enormously. Hunter Biden profited needlessly. He wasn't needed, but the Chinese brought him in as a way of funneling money to him. And the general gist of both stories is that the Chinese have come in and safety has gone to hell and people are dying and kids are dying and everyone's dying and it's all... And look, we made a documentary called Mind Your Own Business. The one thing all these mining groups, anti-mining groups say, it's all these American companies are always terrible with safety, but they've never any statistics to back this up. The reality is a modern mine in these countries is one of the safest places you could be in these countries. They have security, they have hospitals, they have medical care, they have seat belts, they have roads, they have, I mean...
An American-run mine.
But it's always all these allegations. And of course, by the way, in a mining situation where 2,000 or 20,000 people are hired, you're going to have accidents and you're going to have people who are not following the rules. Now, we were on a 20-day shoot in Serbia. John James ended up in hospital for a couple of stitches. But now, because they want to fashion this story as some kind of anti-Chinese story, I don't know why they're particularly concerned about that. Now it's suddenly the Chinese. Now the American mining company was the paragon of virtue, and now it's the Chinese that are the dangerous people. As the New York Times says, safety is just on paper, and they say number of accidents has risen dramatically, but they don't give any statistics. Mm-hmm. They give no figures. They give descriptions by a former employee and an anonymous current employee, and that's it. And we know from covering mining stories is, and of course the anti-mining groups come in with comments as well, we know that you cannot trust the Chinese government, right? But you really cannot trust anti-mining groups in these developing countries because they lie through their teeth and the media publish what they say without any questions or without any demand for statistics. They ask for statistics and facts of American companies, but they don't ask for statistics and facts of the anti-mining groups. You know, as I remember saying when people would ask me about gold mining, I said, look, if you're the CEO of an American mining company and you lie, you could be prosecuted by the SEC, by your insurance company for fraud, you could be sued by your investors. You could end up in jail, actually, for misleading your investors. You could end up in, so there's all these groups, there's all these consequences for lying that are very not good for you as a CEO. If you're an anti-mining group and you lie, you get awards, you get CNN's Hero of the Environment, you get more money for your group. But people take anti-mining groups allegations seriously, and they don't take denials by the mining companies seriously. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the Chinese are being accused of all this, and you almost feel sorry for the Chinese because, you know, they're not going to win. And look, I don't know if...
I don't feel sorry for the Chinese.
Well, look...
And by the way, it's a really... I mean, there's an awful part to this story, which is the fact that now basically the Chinese have a monopoly on the world's cobalt, basically. Basically, mm-hmm. they have a monopoly on all of the world's cobalt. And that cobalt is very important for the very green energy that we're all being now forced to use in order to keep the lights on. I think it's just a truism that the Chinese are bad people. The Chinese government, the CCP, are really, really bad people. And these are the people now who actually really, by default, are in charge of keeping the lights on for you and me and everyone around the world.
Well, I mean, guess who was vice president when the Chinese were allowed to get a monopoly on the world's cobalt? Joe Biden. And guess whose son was profiting enormously from the Chinese getting a monopoly on the world's cobalt?
This is not
an accident. I mean, sometimes the governments are incompetent and don't see what's in front of them. This was right there in front of them. And you might say that Joe Biden looked the other way. He was in charge of foreign policy, as the vice president is. And he allowed the Chinese to do this. A, because he probably doesn't care. And B, because his his son was profiting by millions of dollars. Welcome to America, and welcome to the real reason we're making My Son Hunter. So don't forget mysonhunter.com. We would appreciate it. Now, Anne, on to the next story. I haven't told you the story. So it's a farming story from the Irish Independent. I want everyone, don't be reading it. Don't be reading it, Anne. I can see you cheating.
I'm not.
Such a little cheat. So I'm sure everyone out there going, why is Phelan reading us a story from the Irish, a farming story from the Irish Independent?
I'm wondering that.
Right. So this is just how to tell a story without telling a story. And it's the same all over the world. And you want, you know, the Irish media are just as bad as every other type of media, the New York Times. So here's the headline. Major farming demonstration to take place in Dublin City this lunchtime. And it's like, major farming demonstration. Normally you would say farmers to protest, you know, sheep regulations, but it's just a major farm. What's the demonstration about? Okay, let's go to the first paragraph. The Irish Farmers Association Save Farming Protest Plan for Dublin. Okay, that's the sub headline. It's by Paul Hyland, and you know, we're now two headlines in, and we still don't know why they're protesting. What, you know, and do you know why they're protesting at this stage?
Well, you didn't tell me, so I have no idea.
So here's the first paragraph. Irish farmers will hold a major demonstration in Dublin city centre to highlight concerns over demands being placed on the farming sector.
Okay.
Demands? What demands?
I think I know. Can I guess?
No.
Oh.
No, you can only guess based on the paragraphs, right? You can't guess based. So you're just a reader, right?
No, but they don't tell you anything in the paragraphs. So you can't guess.
Well,
so, but I can guess. I know what this is going to be about.
The protest is part of the Save Irish Farming campaign and is replacing the Irish Farmers Association Farm Family Rally, which was modified due to increase in COVID figures. Yawn, right? I mean, so we're still, they're going to block Dublin City Centre with tractors, right? Mm-hmm. Hold up commerce.
But we don't know why.
We're now at the end of the second paragraph.
So we still don't know why.
Here's the third paragraph. A convoy of tractors and farm vehicles led by IFA President Tom Cullinan will arrive in the city at lunchtime. Why?
Still don't know.
Speaking ahead
of this. Can I just say, when I was trained by Phelan McAleer to become a journalist, you would be very unimpressed with the story if I'd written it like that, Phelan.
Yes,
because you would have said, well, I don't know why you're telling me about all these people when you haven't told me what the story is about.
Yes.
I don't care who the president of the IFA is. All I care about is why are they protesting. Okay, yes. Moving on.
Speaking ahead of the event, Mr. Cullinan said, every policy of this government, including the proposed national strategic plan to implement the common agricultural policy, is designed to reduce production. Farmers are being asked to do more and more for less.
Still don't know.
Still don't know what they're protesting. There's something about the common agricultural policy.
I know what it is.
Being asked to reduce whatever the production.
COP.
We, and as a continuing his quote, COP. We have consistently called for genuine engagement and negotiation.
I'd like Phelan to lose the Irish accent. It's pretty bad.
With farm organisations to develop a farm-level plan that farmers can work towards achieving. I still don't know what he's talking about.
God bless us. What paragraph are you in now?
I think we're in number six.
Oh, my God.
To date, nothing has been forthcoming. You love the way these people talk.
Keep going. Oh, I know. Nobody writes like that. Yeah, nobody talks like that.
All farmers have received is empty record. Empty rhetoric and lofty targets.
Interesting you talk about empty rhetoric. They're doing a great job of empty rhetoric themselves.
This is empty rhetoric. Now it's paragraph six and we still don't know what they're protesting. Empty rhetoric and lofty targets with nothing to back them up.
Keep going.
Uncertainty is detrimental for any business.
Tis.
Farming is no different.
Tis so.
Farmers are reaching the end of their tether.
God between us and all harm.
Right?
Oh, dear God.
And now I think we're going to get to the actual reason for the protest in about paragraph eight.
And there'll be a reason now why they buried that now.
Mr. Cullinan has argued that farmers are, quote, very conscious, close quotes, of the climate challenge and want to play their part. They're basically protesting about climate change regulations that's going to destroy their industry. Because in Ireland, right, there's very few cars, there's very few cities, it's pretty rural. The biggest contributor of carbon dioxide in the Republic of Ireland
is cow fart.
Is cow farting and sheep farting and pig farting.
All that farting.
All that farting. And so they're being being told. Like this is
so paragraph nine.
If a British landlord had done this 150 years ago, there would have been a revolution before there's a revolution.
So the headline basically should read, Irish farmers protest crazy climate regulations.
Climate change regulations. Yeah, that's going to destroy the Irish family farm. So that's how Ireland reports the first climate change protest. And there's going to be many more. Because as I was saying, this is going to decimate In fact, it's one of the few examples when the word decimate isn't appropriate, because decimate, it means 1 in 10. This is going to destroy the small Irish farm. And if it, as I said, if it's been done by a British landlord, there'd be a revolution, but it's not. It's been done by a Brussels landlord. It's been done by the United Nations. It's been done by, in fact, and it's been done by the Irish ruling elites, who are... Ireland has no contribution to the world's, was it carbon dioxide? And when I say no, I mean no statistically significant contribution to carbon dioxide from across the world. Cutting its farming will just destroy the Irish economy. China will continue to puff away, and India will continue to puff away, and Indonesia will continue to puff away, and Russia will continue to puff away. And by the way, so will America. But Ireland will be seen to be good children, and that's what they really want in the world. So, you know, it's their climate change bill is the longest suicide note in history, and the farmers are protesting, and the media is pretending they're not. So, what's next, Dan?
State of Wisconsin versus Kyle Rittenhouse. We, the jury, find the defendant Kyle H. Rittenhouse not guilty.
Kyle Rittenhouse. Let's talk about Kyle Rittenhouse, because I think we are particularly well situated to talk about the case. We have covered so many court cases in our journalistic career, particularly shootings. I've covered a lot of shootings, a lot of bombings, and I've also covered cases where people have alleged self-defense, such as soldiers and police officers in Northern Ireland. And, there's two aspects to this story that really need to be emphasized, that this was a failure of policing and politics at the beginning. Kyle Rittenhouse would not have been on the streets if the political class had decided that burning and looting was something to be discouraged. Mm-hmm. People forget that those, and the media, by the way, were misrepresenting this burning and looting as mostly peaceful, as passionate, just those crazy kids, those crazy passionate kids. 30 people died during that summer of mayhem to get the orange man out, basically. Whatever happened, BLM, by the way, black men are still being killed by police officers, apparently. But no protests, no rioting. So political class told the police not to interfere in this. The media applauded that and encouraged these, what they really were race riots. So that left a gap that was filled by the likes of Kyle Rittenhouse. And it doesn't matter whether he's 17 or 70, he was filling a gap. And it was legal. I mean, so it was a failure also of journalism, but it's not much a failure. It's malfeasance of journalism, media malfeasance. They knew what they were doing, because it was very clear within 12 hours of that shooting, there was so much video footage out there. It was very clear that he did not fire until he was attacked. And he was running away from most of these people.
I mean, one of the things that was amazing about watching the trial, and by the way, that was one of the, I think that's, I mean, if it was ever an argument for having cameras in court, this is the argument, because, you know, people didn't know the story, and the reason they didn't know the story is because the media never reported on it, and if they did report on it, they reported on it incredibly inaccurately, calling this guy and reporting that he was a white supremacist. I mean, one of the things, actually, I didn't say this to you, Phelan, but it's still happening, is the number of newspapers, particularly international newspapers, who continue to describe the guys that he shot as black. So it's really funny. The British Independent has that as the story, that he shot three black men, and that has been reported by lots and lots of people. That reflects how badly reported on this story was. And what was really good, and I luckily actually, when I was in Serbia, because of the time difference, I don't know, whatever it was, I was able to watch quite a bit of it, and it was kind of extraordinary, particularly to watch the guy who survived.
It was compulsive,
being told, you know, explaining that actually, yeah, he was pointing a gun directly at Kyle Rittenhouse when he was shot.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, that's not actually what you should be doing. But it was very interesting to watch and to hear the testimony and to hear the prosecution and to hear the defense. The defense were, put up a great, their argument was, of course, you know, self-defense, and actually they proved it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing that we're not big experts on, is the American gun laws or gun culture. But I think no matter where you are in the world, if someone points a gun at you, you are entitled actually to kill them. And funny, this was explained to me, because when I did the Ferguson play, I remember talking to people, and a lot of the actors were going, why didn't he shoot to wound someone? So I went off, I asked, and in fact, I asked, and then I read, when you read the transcripts, the police officer in Ferguson was asked, why didn't you shoot to wound? Why? Anyway, I think he was asked by a grand jury member. And the reality is, shooting to wound sounds like a good thing, and mm-hmm. you see it happening in the movies. If you point a gun at someone, they don't think you're shooting to wound them. They think you're shooting to kill them. That is, if someone come in there and point a gun, I think the first thing is, I'm going to die. If you have a gun, you will try and kill that person. Mm-hmm. So even if you are wounded, you don't know. You don't think they're trying to shoot to wound you. You think so. You will respond to kill the person. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, you have to shoot to kill. You have to, because, and also, if like Michael Brown, he was on a criminal spree, mm-hmm. and you shoot to wound, and he goes off and then kills someone else as part of his criminal spree, and that's what he was on that day. He committed many felonies and robberies that day. Then you're actually, you know, you're wounding someone and angering them, and then they'll go on to commit more crime and even more serious crime. And it is a very valid question to ask people. Why wouldn't you shoot to wound? But I think, of course, the media, if they were any good, they would explain to people that's why. And another thing is, shooting to wound, you'd have to try and shoot their arm or their leg, which is a very small part of their body. Unfortunately, to be effective, you have to shoot at the biggest part of their body, which is
the torso.
And so for all those reasons, shooting to wound is not viable and is more dangerous, interestingly enough. It's kind of counterintuitive.
But it was incredible when the verdict came back, and it was, you know, not guilty on the five, I think, the five different charges. You have a jury situation there who have diligently listened to evidence over a long period of time, and they've made a decision, and they didn't make it rashly. They didn't make it after 3 hours. They made it after 3 days. And then having that, mm-hmm. having people around the country, you know, actually just... completely, you know, show disrespect for that verdict based on politics, not on facts. Yeah. It's really terrible, and it's very dangerous, by the way, when that happens. Because
and some of them know better. Some of them know better.
Of course they know better. Well, Kamala Harris, by the way, particularly Kamala Harris knows better. She's a lawyer.
Yeah, and Joe Biden. The thing is, some people have been misled by the media, right?
Yes.
And they believe that Kyle Rittenhouse shot black people. They believe he went on a killing spree. They don't know that every person he shot was attacking him. Mm-hmm. And you know, with skateboards, one guy had a gun in his hand, a gun in his hand that he pointed at him. And he says, and he had agreed under oath, yes, that Kyle Rittenhouse did not fire at him until he pointed the gun at him.
Yes,
right? And then the other guy was trying to grab, had his hand on the gun.
The videos told the whole story.
But those videos were out within minutes of the killings, right? And so people like Kamala Harris, people like Joe Biden, and people like the elite media. Look, we have such resource. I have got limited resources, but I've got a lot more resources and time to look at these things than our audience out there. These elite media types, they have unlimited resources. They can lift. I mean, it's a great thing about being a journalist. And I always say this: I can lift the phone tomorrow and phone the sheriff of that town and ask him a series of questions, and he's practically obliged to answer, mm-hmm. right? Or his PR person is obliged to answer. They can actually do this. They didn't do that because they didn't like the response they knew they were going to get, and they're playing a dangerous game. And it's dangerous because of violence, but it's also dangerous for their own self-survival, because people will be asking themselves, why? As that lady said to me outside the Ferguson play in New York,
what was I protesting?
Why was I protesting when this is the truth? And people are going, why did I believe that Michael Brown was murdered when it's clear from the evidence that came out he wasn't? Why did I believe that Kyle Rittenhouse was going to be sentenced to life in prison when it was clear almost before the trial opened that there was no chance of a conviction? So this is going to damage the media, and you know, and. You know, this is why when people say, oh, the media is dying, we've got to preserve the media. No, you're killing yourself. If you were to provide a product that was truthful, that was honest, that was necessary, that was honest and hurtful to your own side, that told stories that you didn't like telling, then you'll actually find people will click on your site or buy your newspaper. They're not going to do that if you keep telling them what they want to hear and then them finding out 6 months later that the truth is somewhat different.
But it's also very, very, very damaging to people's faith in the system, the justice system. If you have the media, if you have the media in one voice saying that the verdict is wrong, it's not true. It's not true at all, by the way. Anyone who watched the trial knows that the verdict was absolutely spot on. In fact, people feel that the Kyle Rittenhouse should never have ended up at trial. It should have been thrown out immediately on the basis of the evidence that they had. But they did go through with this lengthy trial and the lengthy time that the jury had to answer that. But it's a very, very bad thing for leaders and elites to basically say that the jury were wrong when in fact the jury were right, and it does damage people's faith in justice. And it's very dangerous, and it's an awful thing that the media have done. It's super, super irresponsible. They're just liars. Yeah. They're just liars, and so is Kamala Harris, and so is Joe Biden. What was Joe Biden's initial response? What did he say?
Angry.
Anger. And then her, she was disappointed. Don't be disappointed. That's not your job.
She needs to cheer that the jury
system.
Isn't
it great that the jury system works? And these people are, you know, took their job very, very seriously. And the judge was a joy to watch, by the way. Yes. He was wonderful.
The idea that any journalist in the country would find it objectionable that the judge said you cannot call these victims, that's for the jury to decide.
Yes.
The prosecutor cannot call them victims. They're not victims. They're complaining witnesses. They're injured people. They are not victims until the jury says they're victims. One thing I would say, just wrapping up, was we were watching a lot of this in Serbia whilst making the My Son Hunter movie. And I have to say, now, I was kind of envious. I was thinking if we had been in America at the time, we'd have been up there at Kenosha doing a daily podcast on that because it's a great story. And maybe we'll come back to it. Maybe we'll do some more creative stuff on this. Let us know if you'd like us to do a play or a movie or a podcast on it. Do you think there's an appetite out there for it? I'm very interested, but I want to know if you would listen to it, if you want more information on it. Or you think you know it all now, maybe because it was televised. But I know, I'm very aware that people can only dip in and dip out and see things on Twitter or Facebook. And we all know that those clips can be very deceptive. So maybe there's a bigger project out there. Let us know if that would be something that would interest you. Let us know in the comments section of the YouTube or the comments section of the podcast app or anywhere you listen to this podcast.
So we're going to go over to an interview I did earlier with Detective Jim Wood, who has a brilliant, heartwarming story that I just read on the plane yesterday coming back from
perfect
Thanksgiving fare. But Jim Wood, you'll remember, is a detective who discovered Dr. Kermit Gosnell operating this abortion clinic in West Philadelphia that is the basis of the movie Kermit, the movie Gosnell that we made, and the best-selling book that we wrote called Gosnell. And so Dr. Kermit Gosnell is serving three life sentences. As you'll remember, he delivered babies alive and then cut their necks with scissors, and he did this for a whole career. Don't worry, the interview we're having with Jim in a moment is very heartwarming. It's not to do with any of that, but I just wanted that's how we met Jim Wood, Detective Jim Wood.
He's a real detective hero. He's a real, he was an undercover drugs operative, and he knew something wasn't right there. And he had Kermit Gosnell on sites for selling opioids. And he went in and found a scandal, found a crime that was going on in open sight, and fought for those victims. And it's because of him Kermit Gosnell's in prison. But he has another side to him, a family side, a religious side, a spiritual side. And this story, I think your interview with him is going to really show the people out there a wonderful Thanksgiving story and an example to us all. Let's go over to that interview now.
So now we are joined by our dear, dear friend Jim Wood and his wife and his wife's twin sister, because of this incredible story that Jim just sent me yesterday. Wasn't that right, Jim? I was literally on the plane yesterday and you sent me this fabulous story. And I just thought this is like a Thanksgiving story. First of all, I want to just say I'm very thankful for knowing Jim and knowing Angela. I don't know you, Andrea, but I mean, obviously anyone to do with the woods works well for me, you know. We were very grateful to know Jim and what he did for this country and for the small children everywhere. Is amazing. And by highlighting the story of Kermit Gosnell and getting this story out there, you know, and I haven't even updated you lately, Jim, but people's lives are saved all the time because of the inspiration of this story. Dr. Kermit Gosnell, Dr. Kermit Gosnell is in prison for 3 life sentences, but people who hear the story choose life over and over again because of the fact that we got this story out. And the reason we got this story out was because of you, Jim. So thank you.
Thank you. And God bless you for all your hard work.
So you sent me an unusual story, and it starts, I think this story starts with the girls, with Angela and Andrea. Tell us what happened.
You go first, Ange, because you got the call from London.
Well, I got a call from my sister, Rhonda, who watches over closely our parish we grew up in that we love very much. And there was some change going on. To make a long story short, they were going to be making some changes, and part of those changes included getting rid of a lot of meaningful pieces, the statues being some of the most important things. So when my sister Rhonda called to tell me that, and she said, it's imperative that you get there right away. And so I made a call to Angela, and we got our acts together quickly, and we headed on down.
So this is the parish that you guys, where you were growing up, right? And
exactly.
When you got down there, you found one of the statues, a statue of the Virgin Mary, had been damaged. How badly damaged?
She was laying on the ground, broken off straight across at the bottom, and the pedestal was all broken apart and
rubble.
And she was literally laying in a pile of rubble.
This Virgin Mary was very important to you when you were growing up, when you were children. What did she mean to you, that statue, that very statue?
I told Jim that I was a real anxious child. I had a lot of anxiety in grade school, particularly like first grade, second grade, third grade. And they would always walk us over to First Friday Mass. You'd have to pass right by her. And I would stop and just pray my little heart out that I would just get my strength and be more courageous and less fearful. And each year I felt stronger. And so I remember that about that statue, about the Blessed Mother. That's where it takes me, way back to my childhood.
And so you go down there and find that basically the Virgin Mary is in pieces. So what was your idea? What did you decide to do?
Well, we wouldn't let Jim leave the parking lot because she lays there in a pile of rubble. There was no way we could leave her there. And this was the last or second to the last day that we were allowed to come on the property to claim whatever it is we wanted to claim. And Jim has a tiny Subaru. After sitting on the ground for 45 minutes or an hour, we decided we'd ask a couple people for help to lift her up. And I'm telling you, it was probably, I don't know, close to 1,000 pounds, 800 pounds or whatever.
And this is where the story I thought takes a funny turn, actually, because you got a particular gentleman who was working around that place on the site to help you. Tell us more about him.
That was you, Jim.
What happened, Ann, is so I looked at the statue and just tried to pick it up, and literally I couldn't. But the girls were still walking around the church and the school, just reminiscing about their childhood. I mean, I could see it in them. Just their faces were so in awe, remembering their childhood there. And the gentleman, he was Muslim. And Angela and Andrea started talking to him because there was a reporter there who had tried to get access to the building and was unable to. They wouldn't, because they're doing the work there. However, when the girls came along and charmed them, boom, he started showing them around through the buildings, giving them pictures. I thought I was only walking away with a picture. I didn't realize the Blessed Mother was broken and it was going to lead to what ultimately happened. So that gentleman ended up, I think, slowly understanding the necessity of him and his workers to help load that statue into the car.
And you said to him, but this whole Muslim thing came up and you were like, well, you probably don't even realize how important the Blessed Mother is to the rest of us. And then he said, interestingly enough, he gave you an education, right?
So he said, we love Mary. And it shocked me. The younger Muslim man had said, we know who Mary is. We love her. And that totally shocked me because I never understood that. And then when Gina wrote that article, she had looked up another bishop that talked about that and the how our religions are joined in different ways. The Jewish, Muslim, and Christian religions are all tied in, and we all believe a certain, you know, amount of each religion. And it was very inspiring because I was trying to say, oh, you don't understand the blessings that Mary's going to put upon you. And that's when he made that statement.
And he said, I'm very aware that she'll be putting blessings on me. So then he got his workers together. You got this in the back of the Subaru, and then you brought it home. And then the next question was, how do you put it back together again? And I think who else in the family came up with the great solution?
So my initial idea was she was so heavy. I thought we were going to have to get a harness for the top part to lift her up. My son, Jimmy, and myself were able to lower her down out of the car onto a dolly. And we wheeled the dolly up under the pine tree in front of my house. And then we also loaded the lower part. I mean, each piece, the one piece probably weighed 600 pounds, the other piece 400. And we got her over to the tree and she was in pieces. And the next step was supposed to be, I was going to drill holes.
And do rebar, right?
And yeah, and then put rebar in and then cement it that way. But my son-in-law, Mike Whitman, he's the state trooper and very handy. So him and my son, Jimmy, said, no, I think we just need glue. So
glue.
It was a couple weeks later. They got her. I don't know how they did it, but they lifted the top up and put her back together. And we let her cure for about 6 days. And she looked like she wasn't even broken apart.
And now she is in pride of place between your two houses, right? Because you got some houses up in the hills there, and it's between the family, two family houses. Is that right?
That is correct. And it looks like that location, which Andrea's husband, Paul D'Annunzio, picked the spot.
Oh, yeah.
And perfect. His father, his two aunts are nuns. And his father loved Blessed Mother. And his father actually gave everyone in the family a Blessed Mother for the front of their house. That's how much wow. He adored the Blessed Mother.
Well, as you said, you placed her, I think, very particularly so that people driving past will see her from the road.
Absolutely, because she's sitting up on a hill right in between the two properties, right over the road and onto the field and the mountain in the background.
Well, Angela, you think, Angela, from those days when you were a little one, all full of anxiety, full of stress, to where you are now and to where the Blessed Mother is between the houses. It's kind of a wonderful story. I just read it and I just thought, I just love this story. I just have to. And I just think it's a real Wood family story, you know, I just think it's a fantastic story. I thought it was a great story for Thanksgiving. And what are you going to do? Where are you going to be for Thanksgiving? When I think of the Woods having Thanksgiving, I'm thinking, how many people are going? How many turkeys are involved here?
So that's a good question for Andrea to answer.
Okay, Andrea, you're in charge.
Yeah, they host it every year. We love Thanksgiving. It's our favorite holiday. And the more people we have in our house, the better. We always cook at least two turkeys. We start the day before. Sometimes it's three if we know that everyone is definitely coming. But
how many have just one moment now? How many is everyone?
Well, we're down to 25 now. Oh, but I think it's easy. Yeah. I think we're down to 25, but we've had upwards of 40.
Yes,
and it's just the best. It is the best. It's what it means. It's what it's supposed to be.
Yes,
but
yes.
You're right. This story warms your heart. And never in a million years would I thought when we were out on the school ground playing, when Mary was watching over us, that she'd still be watching over us, you know, with Angela, you know, battling cancer. Yeah. This is exactly what we needed to happen. Yeah. It's going to give her strength.
Yeah.
And it's going to encourage her. And I just know that it's going to help her spiritually and in every way.
Yeah.
So this Thanksgiving means more this year than it has in a very long time.
Well, that's kind of why I wanted the story. And I'm glad you mentioned about Angela, and we're praying for Angela, and that you're going to be back to your old self before too long.
Thank you.
And we put a little distraction on her. And like with our daughter having the baby recently, mm-hmm. and the mountain properties on the day of settlement, she had just received her treatment like 3 days earlier. So she really, we try to do the distraction thing, and she really hung in and did a great job.
I just love it. I love it. We love you guys. We really do. Looking forward to the next time we see you. So 25 people. Oh, sure. Listen, it's nothing for Thanksgiving. Two turkeys. And then Angela, I presume you and Jim are making sides at least, right?
Yes, wine. We're bringing the wine.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, no, that's very, very.
That's the side that I'm looking for.
I think
it doesn't let me do anything.
I think
she's 4 minutes older than me, so I have to listen to her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That makes sense. No, that makes sense. Well, listen, we wish you guys the very happiest possible Thanksgiving. And we are very, very thankful to have you in our lives. It's been, Angela, every time that we've met, it's been like, I don't know, we're related now. I mean, it's kind of like, that's it. We're family now. So we just love you guys. Right. Have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving. And thank you for sharing this beautiful story.
Same with you guys.
God bless.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Well, that was really lovely. I mean, that was a fantastic, and I think kind of perfect for Thanksgiving. Jim is a gift, and we're so lucky that we know him.
Yes.
He's basically our family now, and we're very happy to have him as a member of our family, I can tell you. He's really fantastic. So the last thing we're going to do today, actually, is, and a few of you had asked when we were in Serbia, everyone wanted recipes from Serbia. So the first recipe that we did, I got help from the hotel, again, very kindly. Nicholas, the manager of the hotel, organized for the chef to make the šapska salad. The famous Serbian salad. This week, I got another friend, actually, another one, the catering company that catered for the film on set were brilliant, by the way, and the food was really gorgeous. And particularly one thing that I've always liked when I was in Serbia during all the time they were there, they have this cheese pie, the Serbian cheese pie, Jivanica. But Dragan, who works for that company, was very kind. I was saying to him, oh, I love the cheese pie. And he said, okay, I'll film it for you. If you look at what he's doing here first, so he's got a large container there. Again, I think what's good about this recipe is that for Thanksgiving, this is something that you can make.
I mean, I have to say, it was being served at the set, at the catering on the movie, and it was just delicious. It was one of the memories we'll take home from Serbia. But go ahead there, Anne.
So he starts off, in this particular case, Dragan did, he did 9 large eggs. You can see him breaking the eggs there into he's using the Tupperware container, actually. Funny enough, I do that. I think those long Tupperware containers are great for cooking. So he's breaking up those 9 eggs in there. Into that, he is going to add a lot. Look at him now. Look at him breaking up that feta. So I think that's feta cheese.
It's a pound, isn't it?
And I think he used about a pound there. Again, we don't have all the quantities, but we're going to go and guess there that there's about a pound of feta.
Yes.
Again, see how you can break that up very easily. To that, he's now going to add 4 big large dollops of sour cream. Again, nice big dollops of that. You see that being added again into the Tupperware container that he's using there. Next thing he's going to do then is he's put in 2 sachets of baking powder. You know those sachets. Everyone has them. So there's not that much in them. Throw those 2 sachets in there. Then, interestingly enough, so he's putting in 1/2 bottle of sparkling water in there. Again, another very interesting ingredient. And then into that, he's throwing in, the vegetable oil in there. Sunflower oil, actually, I think it
was
is. That was salt. Mm-hmm. And I think this is interesting. When you see this initially with him using his hand to mix this around, I kind of thought, oh, gross. But you're going to actually see a very good reason for him using his hand to mix this around. So
would you recommend gloves on this situation?
Well, actually, you could use a glove, but you'll see what he's doing here.
You could wash your hands.
But actually, you know what? This guy knows what he's up to here. And
Do you know why? Why would he use sparkly water? What does that do?
Well, it's interesting. I'm just looking there at Magdalena, and her husband uses sparkling water. I know he used sparkling water with something with his burgers. Yeah. I think what it does is it makes them fluffy. I've heard him say that. So it's an interesting ingredient, and I think that's exactly what he's doing there.
Final.
So now he's got the phyllo pastry. One thing with the phyllo pastry, always try and keep it damp. You'll see that. He's moving
fast. How do you keep it damp? Water?
I think you take it out of the packet and you move really, really fast. But if anyone out there, some of you guys who work work with Philo will know. What, see what he's doing then? He's lifting the pieces of Philo, the sheets of Philo. He's dumping it into that, and he's just kind of going to crumple them up and start to fill this really large container. That's a nice large container because this is, as I said, this
I
is something...
I think he uses about $15.
So basically, this is something that I think you could do very, very well, very easily for Thanksgiving. And you'll see him building this up, building it up. There he is. You see that building up the thing. As you say, Philo, I think we kind of counted maybe 15. And that's very, very end when he's finished. Tough. Then he is going to, again, you saw him there, I would say sprinkling probably maybe a quarter of the sunflower, a quarter of a cup of sunflower oil, again, sprinkled over the top of that. Mm-hmm. And then he's going to top that with two large sheets of Philo. You see, you need more than one in order to cover it. So you see him taking the second one there. And then he's tucking it in. See him tucking it in at the sides? So he's going to tuck that in at the sides. I think he is going to, and he's going to do this cutting. Yeah, see him cutting now.
Why does he do that?
Well, it's going to make it really easy for him then to serve it in these portions. Mm. So he's doing that. Then he's rubbing it over, and then he's going to put on, which I saw at the very end, he's just going to sprinkle some sesame seeds at the very top of that. And then he's going to put that in an oven. He said half an hour, and I think he said, you know what I'm going to say? I'm going to say 350. I'm going to say 350 for half an hour. And then you see it come out of the oven. And actually, you know what? Let's just see him and let's listen to him take it out of the oven. And here's what he says.
They ready for cutting and eating.
And there it is.
Ready for cutting and eating.
Original, have a nice meal.
And doesn't it look gorgeous? So I would highly recommend that. I think that could be a really nice surprise for people at Thanksgiving.
Well, yeah, it was definitely one of our favorite meals in Serbia. That and the, what was it called? Braco? The meat pie, the cheese pie.
Which I never had. I never had the meat pie.
It was delicious.
But
delicious.
The other thing that we liked as well was that that lovely sauce that they had as well, which I need to work out how to make that Advar, I think they call it.
I think I'd highly recommend Serbia to anyone who's looking for a holiday or vacation. A different one. You know, there's no beaches, you know, but there's a lot of history there. There's a lot of...
Well, there's the Danube, by the way. There's obviously these rivers that are crisscrossing the country. Yes. And obviously there's a lot of transport there. And we even saw those Viking cruises that you see the advertisements for all the time. So the Viking cruises pulled in when we were there, you know. Yeah. And I have to say, I'm kind of attracted to the idea of a Viking cruise, I have to say. I think the idea of it's lovely because, you know, you wouldn't have seasickness, right?
Yes.
And you'd constantly be stopping places and getting off and having a look. We didn't honestly do much tourist stuff. I was hoping to go outside of Belgrade to see the winemaking area that was quite close to there, but it never happened. We were way too busy. But and I just want to remind everyone, by the way, that it's 5 months and 3 weeks since it was revealed that Hunter Biden used the N-word, and the mainstream media have failed to report it. So, you know, that's another reason why we need to make this film.
Yes.
And so go to mysonhunter.com and give what you can. And we are so, so grateful to you. We are so grateful to be home and back with the cats. And the cats are doing great. Top Cat's doing fabulously now.
A little limp.
Just a small limp. But we hope that wherever you are for Thanksgiving, that you have a wonderful time. And that, again, as we said, that you think about us and we think about you. We're very grateful to know you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.